Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing Watson X Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM. Let's create.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb. Joe is out today, so I'm going to present an interview here with Paul Szymanski, co-author with Jerry Drew of the new book, The Battle Beyond, Fighting and Winning the Coming War in Space. Paul Szymanski has 49 years of experience in all fields related to space control, policy, strategy, simulation, surveillance, survivability, threat assessment, long-range strategic planning, and command and control. I do want to advise listeners that this one gets a little more into topics of contemporary and near future warfare. I realize that is not everyone's cup of tea, so just fair warning about that. But without further ado, let's get right into this fascinating chat. Well, Paul, welcome to the show. The new book is The Battle Beyond, Fighting and Winning the Coming War in Space, co-authored with Jerry Drew. It's a detailed breakdown of the emerging technologies and ideas that are going to define war and warfare in space. And you've certainly a great deal of expertise in this field. How did you become interested in outer space, and how did your career end up moving into this domain of space systems and space warfare?
Well, first of all, I actually have six books out. Okay. They all begin with the title, you know, that you mentioned, and then there's various details. One is about how to fight and win space wars. Another one is on Sun Tzu, the ancient Chinese philosopher, translated from 2,000 years ago to space. I always liked the bigger picture thought, and so I've always worked at think tanks, you know, not for profit. Semi-government kinds of things. And the first think tank I worked at decades ago, I had the option of either working nuclear war or space war. And I thought, space war, you know, sounds like the, what do you call it, Star Wars and sort of thing, you know, from when I was growing up. So that sounds cooler. I guess I'll go that way. So it was almost a random sequence of events, let's say.
The book does a great job of breaking down a lot of the core concepts, you know, forcing the reader to re-examine basics that a lot of us, especially general science readers like myself, probably take for granted. So getting down to brass tacks, as they say, could you remind listeners what we're talking about when we're talking about the space domain from a military perspective?
Well, one thing, and you know, I'm on, I've been on the boards of directors of Air Force Research Lab, with you know, retired general officers and vice admirals, and one was an astronaut who's been up in space five times, you know, and none of them understand how to fight space wars. It really comes down to it. When you really think about it, you're not attacking a satellite, you're attacking the mission. oh, this satellite's providing imagery for the battlefield. We're about to do a sneak attack. We better take out the guy's imagery, you know. So you need to take out the mission. Oh, by the way, the commander in the particular theater is going to say, deny the adversary imagery of the battlefield over these latitude, longitude coordinates and resolution over the next 72 hours, you know. You figure out how to do it within the laws of armed conflict. So you not only have to take out that satellite, you have to take out the drones, you know, doing the same mission, or the guy on a camel with binoculars. So you have to think that bigger picture. And, you know, the guys I've worked with, they love the technology. We love the technology in this country. But the whole point of war, and even the ancient Greeks understood this 2,000 years ago, the whole point of war is make the other side change their mind, you know. So getting back to, you're not attacking the satellite, attacking the mission, and you're not even really attacking the mission. You're attacking the mind of the adversary commander who's using that imagery information. So, you know, it's kind of information warfare, whatever you want to call it. And that's kind of hard to figure. Like, you know, how do you model a human mind? Did he get this information or not? Did he attack left or right? You know, if you had like an extra $100 million some fiscal year, and you said, well, gee, should I buy one of these fancy new space weapons that we've never tried before? Or should I re-equip an army brigade with newer tanks or something like that? Now, okay, there's politics and this and that, but really, what is going to make the war end sooner with fewer casualties, I guess, or get your point across, you know? And so the Army, they're very used to, you know, they invented what's called operations research. So they're very used to figuring that out. Like, well, if we take out this bridge, it'll take them 12 hours to get bridge laying equipment. And so we delay the forces, you know, maybe 14 hours. And we can calculate in general, the war ends 2 days early and there's, you know, 3% fewer casualties, something like that. I mean, something you could kind of say, well, is that worth $100 million? Maybe, you know. But if you could say, oh, this crusty old general in, I don't know, North Korea or something like that, who doesn't really believe in space. And, you know, even if he gets information from it, he's going to do what he's going to do. His mind is set. And so is it worth $100 million for that space weapon program to deny something he doesn't care about anyway? Now, you know, I'm being a wise guy here at this. Of course, you know, let me tell you something, a very wise guy. And that is, what is the biggest threat from space? And that is something called FOBS, Fractional Orbital Bombardment System. And that's something that the Russians invented in the 1960s. And, you know, instead of sending nuclear ICBMs north, you know, North Pole, they put it into space, the rocket, and it comes from the south and avoids American radars and all that stuff, you know. And it was like 2-3 years ago, the State Department or military, I forget who, said, well, you know, China has FOBs now, the Fractional Orbital Bombardment System. And I'm thinking, okay, you have to, again, think the bigger picture. So we, I don't know if any of our listeners have heard of Mahan, the control of the sea, you know, several hundred years ago, you're saying about, you know, Great Britain and controlling. You say, well, no one's ever been able to control really the seas, you know, Great Britain, oh, the English Channel, maybe the Mediterranean, maybe around Hong Kong and India a bit and all that. But let's theorize. And going back to Mahan, the U.S. is a sea power. It is not a land power. Good luck marching 100,000 soldiers across the Atlantic Ocean to defend Europe. And we've gotten kind of arrogant that, we're just going to do all these wars around the world and they'll never affect us because we got these oceans, the barriers, and no one could send landing craft that far, you know, and all that. And so we, you know, we can get away with a lot, let's say. Now, let's theorize. Let's say you take, you know, I'm being facetious here, but 2 tons of concrete in space and you drop it on all 11 American aircraft carriers around the world. Within 40 minutes, it comes down Mach, I think, 24. Anything coming from space comes that fast. Three times hotter than the surface of the sun. It holds the carrier. There's going to be, you know, gleaming orange, jagged metal. It's going to hit the ocean, the cold ocean, and huge steam explosion. The thing sinks in a matter of minutes. Now, I'm talking about 1960s technology in order to achieve this. And, oh, by the way, some reason we screwed up and we don't have hypersonic weapons. But the Russians have been merrily using them in Ukraine, taking out command centers 400 feet underground. And China, the only reason they developed their own hypersonic weapons is, oh, guess what? Take out American aircraft carriers. Because it's a point target thing. You know, if you use it on the ground and forces attacking on the ground, oh, maybe you kill 50, 100 people, whatever. But, you know, take out command centers, aircraft carriers. So I guess what I'm emphasizing is you better control space or you suddenly become a second-rate power. What can we do if we no longer have our aircraft carriers, we no longer control the sea? Let's say China controls the sea. They, you know, all that oil in the Middle East is worthless if you can't ship it out. And so China starts charging transit fees, you know, anti-piracy fees or something. If you don't pay it, we'll sink your ship too. You know, it's real easy. 1960s technology. You know, we're not actually talking about the future. It could happen tonight. So China, you know, essentially controls the world. Seems to me. I mean, this is theoretical, but I can't think of any holes in that at the moment. And I actually, I'm writing a novel, a seventh book, and it'll be out in a few months. So, okay, that's something to worry about. Now, getting back to the domain of space, everyone I know keeps in the Space Force. And, you know, this has been true of the Air Force I worked with. See, the trouble is, can you think of the last time that the air war was in doubt for the Air Force? And it's like, well, early World War II, not even late World War II, Vietnam, no, you know, in the Middle East, no. So I think there's a certain degree of lazy thinking that goes on because, quite frankly, you learn more from defeat than from victory. I mean, we're teaching Russia how to really fight wars nowadays. So probably 95% of Space Force is Air Force. So I talked to these generals and, you know, lieutenants or whatever, colonels and all that, and they keep thinking tactically, oh, we're going to, you know, slowly maneuver to this satellite and observe it or maybe shoot it with a pellet gun, or the French were telling me they were putting up a laser, you know, and all that. But they're not thinking the strategic big picture. And that is, well, a satellite is strategic. It covers the world. You know, you think you're doing something tactical. Not only are you doing something strategic, and oh, by the way, maybe you're fighting in the Middle East or Ukraine or some of that, but you can attack that satellite in the South Atlantic, you know, from a ship or something, you know, with a laser or direct ascent weapon. You have to think the bigger picture, global. And then you have to think political, too. I mean, wars, you know, political. Unfortunately, we're used to killing people on the ground during war. We're not used to space war. Now, I've noticed this Space Force the last few years is getting people used to that concept. They, you know, they keep their marketing campaign getting more and more severe or something like that. But if you take out someone's satellite, you know, it has consequences. Now, there's a problem and a beauty with space, too, and that is conflict escalation ladder. And I go over that in the book, too. I've sort of learned that countries are just like children. They'll do anything they want if they can get away with it from their parents, parents being the United Nations, their own people or whatever. And so you could think if you go to CIA headquarters in Virginia, there's a wall with all the stars of the agents who died in the line of duty. You know, did any of those start a war? Do we even know who they were? I heard, I think it was 2 years ago, there was an incident between an American and a Russian submarine in the Sea of Japan. You know, I just read in the paper, and that's all they say, an incident, because there's no news camera taking it. You know, they don't know. Mm-hmm. So what I'm getting at is spy warfare, undersea warfare, space warfare. You can get away with a lot, and we have. There's been more intense space wars since the 1960s. I can, you know, show you a bunch of those. And like I said, this, the war that happened in 2014, Ukraine, I could mathematically prove that through the orbital dynamics. So you really have to think the bigger picture. You can't think, oh, this satellite is going to come snuggle up to me and start, you know, messing with me or something like that, because that takes days and weeks to accomplish. Well, my simulations have shown a space war is over with in 24 to 48 hours, you know, a real one where, oh, mm-hmm. I've got 50 space weapons going out right now. So, you know, I think in some sense we would self-deter. You know, I've heard at least years ago that we wouldn't attack a satellite that attacked us unless we knew who owned the satellite, you know, and that's kind of hard to do. They're kind of arrogant, too, and say, oh, we know what satellites have been launched and blah, 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 and all that. And I say, well, you know, every 2 weeks I download the official Air Force satellite orbital catalog, and 40% of the objects there are considered unknowns. We don't know who launched them, who owns them, and what the mission is. So, you know, you know, of what's really happening. And so the first step to defeat in space is overconfidence. Oh, yeah, you know, we're Air Force. We've won every single air war we've ever had, and we'll win the space war. It doesn't take much. The most popular method is cyber warfare. Any country on Earth has clever young kids who can be hackers and hack a satellite. Every country on Earth has a university with high-powered lasers that you can kind of gin up and make more accurate and whatever, and mess with satellites. I mean, I have a laser I got on Amazon, 7-watt laser, handheld, that'll start my furniture on fire across the room in a fraction of a second. You know, I'd put that on a satellite or whatever, you know. I don't think people are really thinking these big pictures. And getting at the popularity of cyber warfare, let me do a thought experiment. And that is, let's say you're in a trench in Ukraine, and you can hear the Russian tanks revving up, you know, ready to come attack you. And some egghead scientist comes into your trench, and he has this black box with a big red button. He says, oh, I've been developing this for years. It's a cyber weapon that'll, you know, if you push that red button, the Russian tanks will stop. It'll mess with their computers or whatever, you know. And, you know, I haven't tested this in the field, but it worked in the lab. Don't worry. And the poor soldiers there, well, what about a bazooka? He says, oh, sorry, we used up all your funding on this, you know, cyber weapon. You know, so the Russian tanks attack. Oh, they push that button, you know, the tanks stop. And 30 seconds later, they reboot and squish you, you know. So I don't know about you, but as a guy, I find it much more emotionally satisfying to see a burning hole in the ground where the tank used to be, you know, as, yep, I did the job. And it's the same kind of with space. Now, of course, I have a whole other briefing I can present sometime. 94 ways to attack satellites without creating debris. You really don't have to do the debris thing. But you're really not sure. You know, people, when they're about to die, get very clever. So you're really not sure if the satellite's faking its death, especially if you use the cyber means, you know. You're not even sure exactly who attacked you. I mean, let's say we're at war in the Western Pacific, China, Taiwan, whatever. And you wake up one morning and several of your satellites stopped working. Well, you know, my computer stopped working last month. You know, maybe that same thing happened. Maybe solar flares irradiated too much. Maybe a micrometeorite hit it. Oh, it's human caused. Oh, this... Romanian satellite came too close accidentally, you know. Oh, no, human cause and intentional. Okay, what is the intent? Now, let's say, oh, it's the Chinese attacking us. We're at war with them. well, maybe it's the Russians or the North Koreans messing with you and starting to stir the pot. How do you know who's doing it? What their intent is? Are they going against command and control decapitation, communication satellites, the imagery satellites, navigation? Are they doing a demonstration attack like, well, we're showing we're really serious now, kind of thing?
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
One of the things that I found really interesting in the book was talking about these various ways, and I believe this is a mix of like proven technologies, and maybe some of them are more possible for the future. But the ways that satellites can and will do battle with one another, I believe you already mentioned grappling as a mechanical grappling, but there are some other techniques in there, and I thought you might discuss some of those.
Well, I've come up with some on my own head, but, most, if not all, satellites have to point very accurately at the Earth, their antennas, their imagery, whatever. So they have what are called star sensors. In the back of the satellite, look at the stars and they could orient themselves because there's no up, so to speak, in space. Mm-hmm. And I theorize, well, if you got one of these inspector maintenance satellites, whatever, and you float behind it and present an upside down star chart to it, would the satellite flip over? Because these are just dumb machines, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of techniques. I don't know, you know, if that would work. Certainly, to my mind, its most effective weapon, not timeliness wise, but if someone comes up there with the manipulator, and you know, China, they gleefully told us about one of their supposedly dead satellites, and they used a satellite, came up close with manipulator arm, and pulled it to what's called, well, sort of graveyard orbit. It's very suspicious. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, so you can pull a satellite out of orbit, but it's an ideal weapon, a satellite coming up close to you, because it's sort of like taking a satellite, putting in a wheelbarrow, going in your garage and going at it. Well, let's drill a hole. Let's cut this wire. Let's bend this. Let's saw that. You know, oh, let's paint the optics with something that, you know, floats away a few weeks later or something, you know. Mm-hmm. So you can do a lot of messing. And there's a lot of people, and unfortunately, one of them is Elon Musk, and I love Musk, but who want to play the commercial entities, who want to play with army soldiers like children. And, you know, Musk said, oh, I'm going to give Ukraine these Starlink terminals and all that. And I'm pretty sure Russia attacked his systems for that. But they don't really understand the consequences. And it's sort of like Merchant Marine in World War II. Well, they got sank too, you know. And I think, I believe there have been attacks on multiple satellite systems, not only cyber attacks, but others during the Ukrainian conflict. So this thought that, oh, I'm just going to play war, and the military is doing that too, that, oh, we're going to take these satellites, commercial satellites, and use them. And, you know, the commercial ones have really cool technology and probably cheaper and so forth. But who pays for them when they get attacked? I don't know how that works. And, you know, they live in what I consider Disney fantasy worlds. Like Starlink, I don't know, 10,000, 15,000 satellites. Well, you got to attack each one. No, you know, I've seen cyber warfare techniques like 35 years ago going through the electrical plug into your computer and all. I mean, people are very clever. They'll always find a way. And I've, you know, theorized, well, Elon's Starlink satellites can tell how close they're coming to each other and have an algorithm to say, oh, we're too close, let's go away. Well, you do a cyber attack, you put a negative sign in that algorithm, and when they get too close, the satellites start moving even closer, and you kill them all at once. You know, I mean, there's always a way on that. So I think it's easy for us to lose a war in space due to overconfidence, due to not thinking strategically. You know, what exactly are the consequences, I guess, militarily, politically, and also getting back to you're teaching your adversary how to fight you better 10 years later or whatever. So maybe you should withhold some weapons and shape not only the future battlefield, but the future political environment of, well, oh, gee, look at this. We won that space war. Look at all that junk floating around. Well, now all your allies hate you. Now there are all these treaties restricting you. Maybe you should have thought of that beforehand and said, well, let's do it this way, maneuver this way or whatever. And so more improbable, this new treaty won't be so bad or something. I mean, think of the political. Now, for years, I've said, oh, look at this cool multi-billion-dollar space weapons program, you know. And I said, well, you know, we're starting to develop this now. Why don't we get the State Department in on this early on? Because they're going to be part of, I don't know, what used to be called National Command Authorities, but they're going to be in the room when the president's deciding whether to attack or not. And if the State Department got on early, they could say, well, if you tweak it slightly, later on, there would be more probable we'll prove it or something, you know. And I was always told, oh, we can't trust the State Department. You know, they'll just reveal, you know, what we got or whatever. And, you know, all governments are like that. Each department hates each other and all that. But I've got over 28,000 members in my space warfare discussion group on LinkedIn. And one of them is a former assistant secretary of state. And he says, yep, you're right. State Department never knew a treaty it didn't like for space, you know, restricting something in space, you know. So we've got all these kind of undercurrents. And getting back to children playing with toys, it's conceivable that, let's say, the Space Force attacks a satellite. They're certainly not going to tell the State Department. They're certainly probably not going to tell the Navy or the Army or whatever. You know, we all have our secrets, I guess.
You know, when I first started reading about the various like anti-satellite strategies in the book, I was reminded almost vaguely of a childhood viewing of the 1967 James Bond film, You Only Live Twice, in which we see early on in the picture a mysterious orbital spacecraft capturing, essentially kind of consuming another spacecraft.
Yeah, it was like clamshell, if I recall.
Yeah, so, you know, I don't know how this roughly relates to the idea of mechanical grappling, or if this is like a snapshot of some, you know, filtered through fiction sort of, you know, 1960s, late 1960s understanding of conflict between spacecraft.
Yeah, well, certainly the Chinese did the grappling a year ago or something. Certainly, but though that was a supposedly dead object. If the satellite's non-cooperative, though, you can certainly do the grappling, you know, over the South Pacific, where we don't have any radars or something. Maybe you could do it fast enough before we understand, or we don't have any ground control stations to say, tell the satellite, oh, start spinning or something like that, you know. Mm-hmm. Though, as soon as you're accomplishing a counter space thing or something that, you know, is trying to defend yourself, the enemy has won, because if you start spinning, you can't do your mission anymore, you know, and he's probably attacking you at some critical time in the battlefield. And so he's, you know, he's done his job. You don't have to necessarily kill the satellite. And quite frankly, there's three major areas that we've talked about for years. I mean, you can go against the satellite, you can go against the ground controller, or you can go against the link between the two. And that's all three ways to do it. So there's multiple ways to skin a cat, I guess, or something like that. That doesn't necessarily involve debris generation. But the James Bond thing, you know, capturing, yeah, you probably could do that. As a matter of fact, you could look up, I think NASA had some net to capture satellites. They were doing research on, I remember seeing that. And I suppose the net might work if it's, you know, spinning or something. But I've had my own theories, like what I call the porcupine defense. And that is, you know, in the 1960s, satellites used to have these long antennas sticking out of the ball, you know. Well, if you had these long wires that you unfurled out, going out, I don't know, half a kilometer or something like that, nobody could approach you. They'd tangle up in the wires. Maybe the wires, you have them electrostatic and you give them a shock, or maybe somehow acidic, or I don't know. I think some simple defenses like that, maybe for close approaches. People talk about, well, we'll start maneuvering out of the way. We see it coming. Well, you know, first of all, if you, let's say you had a space weapon at what are called Lagrange points. They're at equal gravitational potential between the Earth and the Moon. And so they just sort of sit there way out, you know, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of miles, something like that. And all it takes is just a little bit of fuel to, you know, hit it and have it come screaming back down the gravity well and come attack your satellite. And if your satellite, oh, I see something coming, I'm going to maneuver a kilometer or two away. Well, just looking at the physics, the geometry, if you're 50,000 miles away and you saw her, you moved a few kilometers, well, I change a micro radian or something of my trajectory, and I'm coming in like really fast. And I don't know if there's much you can do. I mean, everything can be easily hypervelocity in space. And it's not like you're going to have 50 feet of concrete on your satellite trying to defend from something coming in. I don't think you can defend anything. And, you know, the Air Force, oh, we're going to defend these commercial satellites. And I don't know what that really means. Maybe you try to jam the weapon coming at you or something like that. But I think a lot of people are living in fantasy worlds when it comes to space warfare.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Now, speaking of fantasy and well, James Bond, science fiction in general has, of course, been long obsessed with visions of space warfare. Can you think of any examples that tackle the technology or just sort of the concept of space warfare as we're discussing it now in a way that lines up with the technologies and strategies we're actually facing?
I can't think of any at the moment. First of all, you know, you have TIE fighters. I don't think you can be manned. I mean, you have all this extra weight of oxygen and all the warmth, and they couldn't take the G-forces if, again, you're doing this maneuvering. You know, all of these things seem to have aliens and all because it's more exciting. I don't know if I know of anything. I think The Expanse, I think that got the closest to some of those space battles, you know, between opposing space cruisers or whatever. I suppose you'd still have to have kinetic one way or the other because, oh, you got these great lasers. Well, if you had a mirror-like finish on your spacecraft and, you know, if you spin it, it'd be, you know, depositing the radiation all around. And it's like we have ground-based lasers, but they can't go out to geosynchronous orbit. It just isn't powerful enough. So if you're talking about, I don't know if battles would be from 50,000 kilometers apart or something. I just don't know about how all that would work. And, you know, maybe we're really talking about AI and the machines will be fighting the machines in one way or the other. And, you know, getting back to space war and why, would you rather have a bunch of satellites broken in space, hopefully without debris, because you don't have to use debris causing things, than a bunch of broken Ukrainian cities? And, you know, you're not killing anyone. There's no sense to attack the International Space Station, though just as a funny aside, who knows, 25, 30 years ago, I was at some space conference in Colorado Springs, you know, Air Force, and the general giving the presentation, who, by the way, dressed up in a World War II outfit and acted like Patton, you know, with a big American flag behind him. Anyway, I stopped him on the way out and I says, well, you know, the Russia is on the International Space Station and we are doing like the left hook or whatever. And he had binoculars. A Russian cosmonaut had binoculars on there. What would you do? And his first response was, "I'll shoot him." You know, well, I don't know about discharging a weapon in, putting a hole through the sides, letting oxygen out, and even the political implications. But of course, you know, generals, I guess, sort of think that way on it. I even had some thoughts on if he used a 5.7 by 2.8 bullet, it can penetrate Lexan armored goggles of an astronaut and the bulletproof suits, but it can't penetrate the metal bulkheads.
Hmm. You
know. Oh, Kevlar suits. That's what it is. So, boarding space stations. Would we ever board the Chinese one? Oh, my book does that. But I guess it's a theoretical, sort of theoretical. There's a lot of things in the book that have happened to me in the past, but I won't say which.
Now, we've been talking about space weaponry and the near future of space warfare. But what does all of this mean for, say, the future of space exploration, as well as like planetary defense against near-Earth objects?
Well, I remember there was something on YouTube that's saying, boy, if NASA had the budget of the military, this is what they could do. So, you know, what's more important to you? Self-defense, military-wise, or, well, science, and, oh, this is kind of cool, and maybe 50 years from now we'll be on Mars or something, you know. So it's all a matter of priority, and you could say, well, what about exploring under the sea and things like that? So I don't know. You know, it's an emotional decision for countries to say, well, what's more important to us? Now, I think we're probably almost there or very soon that if a country loses the war in space, they lose the war on the ground. I mean, think of the U.S. again in the Western Pacific. Would they be able to communicate to the carrier battle groups without satellites? I don't know if they use troposcatter comm anymore. You know, would we have our aircraft flying when we don't even know where we're flying? We don't have imagery and we don't know how to avoid the anti-aircraft and what targets to service and all. I mean, you get to the point where war in space maybe is morally better than war on the ground. So how important is that to a society? Versus, oh yeah, NASA, we're exploring this and that. Now I could again be a wise guy and say, boy, Elon, the commercial world sure did a better job of trying to get to the moon than NASA did. You know, they really seem to be failing there and all that. So yeah, pour money into NASA and, or maybe we should just fund the commercial world to do that kind of thing. Or maybe we should just, get contributions from people who think it's really cool to go to the moon or something. I mean, again, I might be an old fogey here, but the Mars, you know, the dust is extremely poisonous and the radiation is extremely bad. And so you're going to end up being underground 99% of the time. You're going to get really tired of that red, not seeing blue and all that. So I can see, you know, if I was younger, oh yeah, you know, go, you know, colonize Mars and all that. Yeah, someday maybe we can put atmosphere on that. But you're talking beyond our lifetimes. And same with the moon. Now, the moon is really weird. I remember when I first started out in the 70s, and someone telling me, oh yeah, NASA asked the Air Force, well, do you want a base on the moon, you know? And the Air Force sort of scratched his head, like, I don't know, it's kind of far away. I guess not, you know. And no one in my entire career, no one's cared about the moon except the last 5, 6, 7 years. And they're all sorts of like here at Albuquerque. We're going to put cell phone service on the moon. So what the hell are you talking about? You know, you're going to pay $10,000 a minute for 3 astronauts, you know, and, oh, you're putting these surveillance sensors on the dark side of the moon. You know, surveilling what? And everyone seems very worried about the whole thing. You know, I could be a conspiracy, say alien this and that. I don't think so. Or maybe I theorize that, you know, when China, when they land their taikonauts on the moon, they plant the flag, abrogate the outer space treaty that says you can't own terrestrial bodies, abrogate that 10 minutes before they land on the moon, say, now we own the moon. You know, sort of like Spain and Portugal, I guess, did for the Western Hemisphere. Of course, good luck defending that kind of thing. So I wonder if they're worried about that in some sense. And I also point out, you know, we have this 1967 outer space treaty that says you can't own celestial bodies. Well, there's over 80 countries that never signed that. You know, I theorize that Elon can take one of his, he was building some launch ships. I don't know. He gave up on that. But you ship it out to the territorial waters of one of these countries and launch to the moon and say, now we own the moon, and or that country, Ecuador or whatever, owns the moon and leases it back to Elon for 99 years, like Hong Kong. You know, I'm not a lawyer, but it sounds like you could do that.
Fascinating. Well, Paul, where can people follow you online? Obviously, the book, again, is The Battle Beyond, Fighting and Winning the Coming War in Space, or this is one of the books. This is the one that I looked at for the interview. That's out now. But if people just want to follow you, keep up with your work, learn more, where can they find you?
Well, I'm mostly on LinkedIn. You can, like I say, I have the 28,000 members of people who are interested in space warfare. So you can communicate through there. You know, just send me a request, I guess, or that, and tell me who you are or whatever. Also, if you looked up The Battle Beyond, How to Fight and Win Space Wars on Amazon, you'll see all six books. And there's ways, I think they have ways of liking me there and, you know, communicating that way. I think there's even a website associated with it and all that. And that's probably the best way.
All right. Well, thanks again for coming on the show. This has been very insightful.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. Thanks again to Paul Szymanski for coming on the show and chatting with me. Again, the book, co-authored with Jerry Drew, is The Battle Beyond, Fighting and Winning the Coming War in Space, and it is available now. If you would like to reach out to Joe and myself, well, you can do so in a number of ways. I'll share that email in just a second. But hey, you can follow Stuff to Blow Your Mind, the podcast feed, anywhere you get your podcasts. Core science and culture episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Listener mail on Mondays. Short form episode on Wednesdays. And on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns to just talk about a weird film on Weird House Cinema. Thanks as always to the excellent JJ Posway for producing the show. And if you want to shoot us that email, you can do so at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.